This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, November 18th, 2008. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, how to start your own poetry movement. We've been hearing a lot about political movements recently. Is conservatism dead? Does President-elect Obama have a political movement behind him, or did just a lot of people vote for him? There are also a lot of poetry movements happening out there, but few of them ever make it out of poetry circles into our cultural consciousness. Producer Sarah Campbell has been investigating how to get a successful poetry movement going.
How would it even start?
You can't just get a bunch of friends together and make something happen.
And could it happen today the way it used to?
I don't think it could happen anymore.
I think it's wide open.
Well, maybe there's no consensus on the viability of new poetry movements, but there is a model out there for how to launch one. The Objectivists. You've probably heard of them, and here's why. In 1931, Ezra Pound convinced poetry magazine editor Harriet Monroe that she should let a young and up-and-coming poet guest edit an issue of her magazine. The poet was Louis Zukofsky, and he recognized immediately what an opportunity this was. There was a catch, though. Monroe didn't just want an issue. She wanted a new poetry movement. Poet and critic Peter O'Leary explains why this was a problem for Zukofsky.
He's 26 years old. He had published fairly widely for a poet so young, but realistically, he wasn't a major poet or he didn't really have a great number of contacts. So
he hit up his friends for their work, and some big-name poets, too, like William Carlos Williams. Not only did this go over well with Monroe, but it actually worked. With that 1931 issue of Poetry Magazine, Zukofsky single-handedly launched The Objectivists. O'Leary says we can look at what Zukofsky did as a kind of how-to. The formula goes something like this. First, choose, say, four really stellar poets and publish them in a high-profile literary magazine.
George Oppen, Karl Rakosi, Charles Reznikoff, and then Zukofsky himself.
That's right. Don't be shy about including yourself among the heavy hitters.
Zukofsky was not a modest poet. We can say that.
Next, don't worry if you find yourself including some bad stuff with the good. Not all the poetry in that issue was memorable, but it didn't matter.
What it did was it ended up amplifying the quality of his poem.
Next step, and this is crucial, frame the poetry with commentary. This is really where Zukofsky locked it in. He explained to his readers what was good about the poems, and then he gave it a scientific-sounding name, objectification.
He's saying that objects have this reality, and a poem is also an object. And when a poem takes on this quality where you perceive its aura, you perceive the fact that it is now a real thing in the world, then that poem has achieved objectification, which is what he calls either rested totality, that's one of his phrases for it, or the variation, the totality of perfect rest.
And don't worry if your specialized terminology initially seems a little impenetrable.
I think it's more that it's mysterious.
For instance, when he's talking about sincerity, Zukofsky points to this one-line poem by Charles Reznikoff.
Aphrodite Urania, the ceaseless weaving of the uneven water.
Here's Zukofsky saying, this is an example of this kind of sincere witnessing of the world. There are things we live among. One of them is the movement of waves across the water.
Many of us, when we discovered late Zukofsky or when we discovered the way language was being used in the art world, et cetera, this was just mind-boggling.
That's Bruce Andrews. He's one of the founders of another successful movement, language writing, that surfaced in the 1970s. Peter O'Leary says they made a name for themselves using some of the same strategies Zukofsky used.
There were manifestos, there were publications, there were selected poets whose work was highlighted.
And although the language writers were reading a lot of Zukofsky, they had their own set of goals for writing.
It was language-centered as different from, centered around something else.
So it could sound any way it wanted. It just wasn't going to be centered around
narrative
or personality.
It wasn't about author expressivity. It wasn't about emotional outpouring.
They wanted to explore the way language operated.
So that's why it came about being called language-centered writing.
Language writers may have done some of the same things that objectivist writers did, But if you talk to Bruce Andrews, you'll hear how some of these things can backfire. Take that all-important theoretical commentary about the poems. Some people,
professional English department people,
may start to give it more attention than the poems.
One of the reasons we stopped doing the magazine was because there got to be more interest in the theoretical writing, which we were doing a little bit amateurishly, I guess you'd say, instead of the poetry.
So maybe it's time to update the Zhukovsky model that's now about 75 years old. Here are some lessons for your poetry movement. First, pick a name you can live with and be prepared for it to take on a life of its own. Language-centered writing, for example, quickly became language poetry.
I've always thought that the term language poetry is a giant emblem of our failure.
A failure, because language writers didn't want their texts to be seen as poetry, but instead as a new genre. And if your name does get co-opted, develop a workaround. Listen to what Andrews does every time he has to refer to his group's name.
Language poet, so-called, language writing, so-called, theorizing, so-called, about so-called language writing, which is what I call it now.
Tip number two, be flexible about who's in and who's out. You won't be able to control it anyway.
Some people from outside might have said, well, what the hell is this? These people are not doing anything that's the same. In other words, why is person X considered a language writer? And you know, obviously you're not going to be able to say, oh, well, it's because, you know, he's sleeping with this person, or he's married to so-and-so, or he hangs out with her. And, you know, you're not going to say something like that. So it just gets vague.
Tip number three, don't just be ambitious, but be doing something new. Make sure you're onto something like the language poets were.
So it really wasn't, gee, let's start a movement, irrespective of whether we're doing anything different or not. It was a sense that, well, we're doing something different. We're doing something distinctive. The interests are shared by a bunch of people, and let's talk about it as such.
But don't forget the Zhukovsky model either.
If we're being honest, in some ways what he's really saying is, this is poetry I like, and here's why I like it.
And last but not least, good luck.
Good luck indeed. In the meantime, you can read Peter O'Leary's article on Poetry Magazine's Objectivist issue on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Also, if you haven't already, check out the Poetry Magazine podcast, hosted by editors Christian Wyman and Don Scher. Each month, they feature readings of poems, and they talk about articles in the upcoming issue. Let us know what you think of this program, where our motto is,
poetry is a giant emblem of our failure.
Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.